You know, it's funny because I started a couple days ago carrying these around with me to light like the burner on the stove and candles in the house. And I also started carrying around a flashlight, but I didn't bring it this morning because I could have held it. But no, I think I'm fine. I think I'm fine. Long story.
All right. If you change your mind, let me know.
As I was preparing for this talk this morning, which is going to be on beneficial, or it's going to be the third in a series on Bodhisattva's methods of guidance. I was told recently that it might be a good idea if people who were speaking introduce themselves, because sometimes people don't know. So I'll start there. My name is Lee Lewis, and I'm a teacher here at the Zen Center, and I've been practicing here since the early 90s.
Also, you're not amplified this morning.
All right. Can you all hear me back there? Okay, good. Thanks for reminding me. As I was preparing for this talk this morning, a couple things happened. Three things happened. One is not terribly related to the talk, but I'm retiring at the end from my career at the end of this week. I have 5 more days on the job. And on Monday morning, I was riding my bicycle up River Road to work, and it was the first day that my successor would be in the office. So we have 2 weeks where I'd be working with my successor and handing things off. It was a lovely spring morning. It was just kind of delightful ride at about 8 o'clock, 7:30, 8 o'clock. And an image came into my head from nowhere, well, probably from somewhere, of my first day walking of kindergarten, walking down Pierce Street to Pierce Street School for my first day of kindergarten. So I don't know what to make of it, but I've been sitting with that as I've been preparing for this talk. Second thing that came up in preparing for this talk is, for some reason, for the last few years, I've been doing talks on a computer. Word processing. But for the first few years that I gave Dharma talks, I did them in a old spiral notebook. And I pulled this, I said, well, I'm going to use this. I'm going to pull this off the shelf. And when I pulled it off the shelf, this is like yesterday, I think, I realized that the first Dharma talk I gave here was around September 15th, 2001. Right after 9/11. And I was really didn't quite know what to do with that, because it was obviously a very somber moment. People were coming to the Zen Center, I think, for a place of refuge in that moment. But I look back, and in fact, the first time I used this notebook was 2004, so I couldn't refer. And I have no idea what I talked about. So that's a little background that coming into this, into preparing for this talk. And I think you'll see how it weaves through the talk itself. Does anybody have a watch I could borrow to keep track of time? I can't read this watch. Oh, there you go. 10:07, okay. So I'm going to talk about the Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance. I've talked about it a number of times prior to this, but this is, I think it'll be the last one in this series. The Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance what are they? They're generosity, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action. They were first mentioned by the Buddha in a couple of different sutras. Welcome. But never really, as far as I can tell, ever commented upon until Dogen wrote an essay about them in the 13th century. And Dogen is the founder of our Soto Zen school, the school that this center is a part of. Since that time, that essay has been commented on by a lot of Zen teachers, but this is the first time that they were ever dealt with other than the Buddha mentioning them as the four methods of guidance, the Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance. And one other thing about the essay, it was written for lay people, and Dogen, most of the essays in Shobo Genzo, his major work of essays, were written for monks and priests. This one was given to lay people. It was written specifically for lay people. Bodhisattva is a being of compassion. It's a bodhisattva that is enlightened, becoming enlightening, and enlightening. It's a being. It's obviously a metaphor. Is that what we call it? It's a being that could step over into nirvana and decides to remain in the world until all beings are saved. So it's and functions as a being in this world, full of compassion for all beings. Now, so we've got these four qualities, and these four qualities we have a lot of lists in Buddhism. Right now there's a group of 20, 25 people who are preparing to receive the precepts, and the number of precepts that they receive is 10, but then we add on three here and three here to get to 16, all right? And in different worlds, if you're a monk, you have hundreds, and if you're a nun, you have hundreds more. So there's a lot of these lists. And this one I find very interesting and have found intriguing for years because it's geared towards bodhisattvas. It's kind of practical. There's not a lot of abstraction here. It's about how you be in the world, and there's only four of them. And one could live one's life by them, I think. So last time, I want to talk a little bit before I dive into the last two, because I've talked about the first two in earlier talks. Dogen approaches these, there are different ways you can approach these guidelines or methods. And one is very practical and generosity, giving, donating, charity. It's translated as charity sometimes, but for some reason we don't use the word charity a lot in Zen. Whereas in Roman Catholicism, in Islam, charity is a value that's held is very highly regarded. We talk about generosity, and there's a difference between charity and generosity. And I'm not going to plumb that one, but I think there is. And I'm not sure which one I think we ought to live our lives by. But Dogen, he offers these, generosity, kind speech, beneficial action, identity action, which is a little confusing, but I'll get to it in a minute. He offers them as practical ways for people to guide their lives, but he also goes very, very profoundly and deeply into them. And I will try to point that out as we talk a little bit about, or I talk a little bit more about these. The reason I got this out this morning is I knew I only had a few pages. I had 4 pages to finish up. I only got through, I had 6. I only got through 2, so I still have 4. So I have talked about generosity and kind speech previously. So today I'm going to focus on beneficial action and identity action. And it really doesn't matter, because somewhere in this essay, Dogen says each one contains each one, so there are actually 16. But again, I don't want to go there. We're dealing with four. It's a very short essay, and I'm not going to read even the, but I won't read the full piece for these. But I thought I would. We need a bigger lectern. Beneficial action. He says, beneficial action is skillfully to benefit all classes of sentient beings, that is, to care about their distant and near future, and to help them by using skillful means. In ancient times, someone helped a caged tortoise. Another took care of an injured sparrow. They did not expect a reward. They were moved to do so only for the sake of beneficial action. These stories refer to ancients, and Dogen is harking back to histories written in the second, and histories of China written in the second and fourth centuries. The story about a tortoise is that this guy, Kong Yu, I think was his name, was in a market and saw a caged tortoise, felt sorry for it, purchased the tortoise, and then let it go. And then when he became a minister, a public administrator, and was having his seal forged, because you had a seal to, I don't know if you stamped envelopes or what you did with it, but as he was having his seal, his official seal, forged, the image of a tortoise was in it. And at that point he realized that his action of kindness is what allowed him to prosper and become in a position of minister, where he could basically help people. The story about another took care of an injured sparrow. This one is from an early Chinese book called Requested by Children, and it had lots of stories about ancient Chinese folks. And this is a guy by the name of Yang Bao, who tended to a little sparrow, just simply out of kindness. And then at some point that sparrow came to him in a dream as representing Grandmother Zi, who was a sorcerer. And the sparrow left 4 white feathers. And Yang Bao's family had 4 prosperous generations, 1 for each feather. And so again, the image is that caring simply out of compassion, with no sense of benefiting oneself, caring for another being has fruits down the road. foolish people think that if they help others first, their own benefit will be lost. This is not so. Beneficial action is an act of oneness, benefiting self and others together. To Greek practitioners, a lord of old, three times stopped in the middle of his bath and arranged his hair, and three times left his dinner table. He did this solely with the intention of benefiting others. He did not mind instructing even subjects of other lords. Thus you should benefit friend and enemy equally. You should benefit self and others alike. If you have this mind, even beneficial action for the sake of grasses, trees, wind, and water is spontaneous and unremitting. This being so, make a wholehearted effort to help the ignorant. So the story about the Lord who was in the midst of his, after a very tiring day being Lord probably, was in the midst of having dinner and bathing, and a petitioner came to his door, and he stopped what he was doing, and he dried off and bundled his hair and got presentable and came out. And he did that three times. He interrupted his bath and he interrupted his dinner three times because a petitioner was at his door. And he was a lord, and that was what lords did. So I'm gonna tell, there's a couple things here that I want to talk about that relate to this. And relate to my upcoming retirement. For those of you who don't know, I'm a social worker by training, and I work for an organization that provides housing to people with AIDS. Social work by its nature tends to be a caring profession that is oftentimes filled by women more so than men. But I've been doing it for 30 years, and I've been asked, how did I get into the specific work that I do, which is AIDS housing? And it started about 1985, when we had this weird disease that people didn't know. I mean, it was called different things. At one point it was called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency, but it was striking young men and it was killing them. And so I volunteered. I simply volunteered with a little organization that would train people to simply be with those young men who were dying. Okay, I think we called them buddies at the time. And my first assignment was a guy by the name of Mark. And Mark was a small-town sheriff in western Wisconsin, deputy sheriff in western Wisconsin. I would guess he was about 25. And when I met him, so he lived in the town that he grew up in. He still helped out on the farm for planting and harvesting. But his job was as a deputy sheriff. And being a gay man in the early 80s, he led a double life. He probably was in Chicago some of the time, and probably in Madison some of the time, maybe in Minneapolis some of the time. But it was a secret life. So he had these two lives, and he had AIDS. Very sick. He was when I first met him, he was at the University Hospital. He was very sick. He was wasting away. Looked like an old man. He had Kaposi sarcoma, which is a blotchy cancer on the skin. It was so weird back then. People didn't know. Doctors didn't know. Didn't know how it was transmitted. Didn't know what to do with it. In fact, they were talking about taking out his spleen just to see if it would be helpful. Literally, that was the state of medical art at that point. So when I first met him, it was at University Hospital, and in order to visit with him, I had to go into a little antechamber and put on gloves and a gown and a mask and go in and visit. And then when the visit was done, step out, and there was a receptacle to put those garments in. And the reason for that, I think, was the medical profession was so, they were just dumbfounded. I think it was to protect me. I think it was to protect the visitor. They were afraid that somehow Mark would transmit the virus to me. When in reality, it was probably a good intervention, but it was more so for me not to give him a bug that would kill him, because his immune system was shot. So I was there on the day that his family came to visit him at University Hospital. It was his mother and his father. I think of them as old people today, but in hindsight, I'm not sure how old they were. They were farmers. His two brothers, who also lived on the farm, and his sisters-in-law, two sisters-in-law. And I remember sitting outside of the room as they went into the antechamber, suited up, and went in to visit Mark, and sometime later came back out, unsuited, and opened the door. And I saw their faces. And in 15, 20 minutes, they had learned that their son was gay. They're a very religious family. That he had this horrible disease, and that he would die within 3 months. And the look of horror, grief, anger, confusion, sadness on their faces could very well have been on my family's faces if they were coming out of that room. That could have been my family. That could have been me. And my reaction was, there but for the grace of God, go I. That could be me in that room. That could be my family coming out. And that was a pivotal moment for me. And if, I think I was in graduate school at the time. So let me tie that into the bike ride to work this past week. As I'm riding my bike into my career's sunset. And I think of myself. The image comes to me of going to grades, first day of kindergarten, walking with my mother down the street. And those two come together in some way. And the way they come together for me right now, come together two ways. One is, all right, that's when I started a structured life, and this is when I'm getting out of it. So that's one thing. But the other one is goes back to there but for the grace of God, go I. I have been blessed in my life in many ways. I mean, I have my demons. We all have our demons. I have my challenges. We have all had our challenges. I've had my low points. We've all had our low points. But I have had, starting with that, well, even before going to kindergarten, but I've had access to a good education. My family was not wealthy by any means, but we had food on the table. We had a roof over our head. Car did get repossessed once, but I've been exposed to cultural things my parents could never have dreamed of. I've been exposed to literature my parents could never have dreamed of. I've been exposed to a world that didn't exist. I'll give you an example. In a few weeks, I will be able to marry legally in the state of Minnesota. I don't know if I'm going to do it, by the way, but I could. I could. And I've been in a relationship for over 30 years, which that is what makes marriage a little irrelevant. But that was inconceivable. When I was walking to kindergarten, that concept was inconceivable socially. Inconceivable. And now it's a reality. So the way that bike ride and or that image of going to grade school and the my experience with Mark's family come together is that two things. One, there but for the grace of God go I, and gratitude for everything that I've been given in my life. And that has translated into a career in social work, the last 12 of which have been trying to get housing for people with HIV and AIDS. Now, you know, in reality, it's not like tending a sparrow or buying a tortoise. I mean, I have gotten paid. I have gotten satisfaction. I have been given opportunities to grow. It's not black and white in that way. I have gotten something. Well, maybe it's that prosperity that for four generations of the white feather. I don't know. Thus you should benefit friend and enemy equally, you should benefit self and others alike. If you have this mind, even beneficial action for the sake of grasses, trees, wind, and water is spontaneous and unremitting. This being so, make a wholehearted effort to help the ignorant. I want to talk just a minute for that piece, because this is where I think Dogen goes a little bit deeper than just do good work. Just asking us, inspiring us to do beneficial action, action that has no self-interest. Because in this line he brings in my estimation, he brings in what we experience when we meditate. He brings in this interconnectedness, this dependent co-arising, this no difference, so that Mark and I really aren't different people. I and the crows that were squawking during Zazen this morning really aren't different beings. That we are all actually, although our concept, conceiving minds don't get it, we are all actually, fundamentally one. And we're this one little, tiny, little, weird dot in a cosmos. And it's the only dot where we've all been able to figure out how to make it work together. Okay. So the learning for me in this was a little bit of that it was a combination of there but for the grace of God, which is another way of saying we're all one, and this sense of gratitude. And I think all of us, and some of us have had very hard lives, but all of us are rich beings and have much to be thankful for. So let me go on to his next idea. It's getting darker here. let me go on to the next one, which is identity action. I'm going to read this first sentence. There are two different translations, and I want to, particularly in this one line, I want to read both. Identity action means non-difference. It is non-difference from self, non-difference for others. And this other translation doesn't use the term identity action, it uses the term cooperation. Now, I prefer identity action, but cooperation's okay. So here, This translator, who's Japanese, this translator's English, American. Cooperation means not being contrary. It is not being contrary to oneself and not being contrary to others. So it goes on. For example, in the human world, the Tathagata took the form of a human being. From this, we know that he did the same in other realms. So he did it with trees, grasses, other universes. When we know identity action, others and self are one. Lute, song, and wine are one with human being, deva, and spirit being. Human being is one with lute, song, and wine. Lute, song, and wine are one with lute, song, and wine. Human being is one with human being. Deva is one with deva. Spirit being one. Spirit being is one with spirit being. To understand this is to understand identity action. This is where, two couple things. One is, and many of you don't know Dogen, but but this is kind of unusual for him to be talking about wine and song. He wasn't much of a wine and song guy as far as we can tell. But again, he was doing this for lay folks. Yeah, this is an essay for lay folks. So this is kind of an interesting, I found it fun. But this also for Dogen, this is where Dogen, in my mind, he goes beyond metaphors of a sparrow, tending a sparrow, and metaphors of tortoises, releasing tortoises. Here he dives much deeper. And he uses language to kind of mess up how you think about it. I mean, you can't think about this in any... Dogen does not, at least I've never experienced Dogen writing magically. And yet he does. I've never found him writing mystically. Well, I have. But it's not solid. And that's the point of it. It's not solid. He goes on. Action means right form, dignity, correct manner. This means you cause yourself to be in identity with others after causing others to be in identity with you. However, the relationship of self and others varies limitlessly with circumstances. So two things here, and then I'm going to read a poem by Thich Nhat Hanh. One is, the idea that this is limitless and always changing. So I could be one with you right now. But you're not going to be the same person the next moment, nor am I. So it's constantly, constantly changing. And so enter change. Enter nothing to get your hands around. So what you're becoming one with is change. And you need to face the moment with total spontaneity. The person that you're going to have coffee with, and you might have had coffee with them afterwards, 16, give them a little space. Don't come at them with the idea that you know who they are. Come to them with an openness and spontaneity and change. So, I want to read a poem by Thich Nhat Hanh that I think gets to this. And many of you may have heard it before. It's called Call Me by My True Names. He wrote it in 1976. So Thich Nhat Hanh is a Buddhist, Vietnamese Buddhist teacher who is held in very, very high regards by many, many people. He's also a political activist. He's a writer, a translator. He was responding to a story about a young girl who was a boat person trying to get out of her country and was raped in the process by pirates. How many of you have heard this poem? Okay, not half. So this is getting to that line, the translation I like better, this idea that cooperation means not being contrary, it is not being contrary to oneself and not being contrary to others. Don't say that I will depart tomorrow. Even today, I am still arriving. Again, we're all arriving, and we're arriving in the next moment, and we aren't the same person in this moment as we were the last, and be open to change in others, be open to change in yourself. Look deeply. Every second I am arriving to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird, with still fragile wings, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I am still arriving in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of every living creature. That concept of dependent co-arising, interbeing, he calls it. I am a mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird that swoops down to swallow the mayfly. I am a frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond, and I am the snake grass, the grass snake, that silently feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks. And I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl refugee on a small boat who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I'm a member of the Politburo with plenty of power in my hands, and I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm that it makes flowers bloom all over the earth. My pain is like a river of tears, so vast that it fills all four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can hear all my cries and laughter at once, so I can see that my joy and pain are one. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up and open the door of my heart, the door of compassion. So there, but for the grace of God, go I. There is gratitude for what I have. There is the opening to interbeing, the realization that we're all one. And there is beneficial. There is the compassion from which arises beneficial action. All right, I'm going to go one more part of this. Essay. The Guanzhe says, the Guanzhe is another one of these ancient Chinese texts. I forget exactly what it's 7th century history, Chinese history. The Guanzhe says, the ocean does not exclude water. That is why it is large. The mountain does not exclude earth. That is why it is high. A wise lord does not exclude people. That is why he has many subjects. My guess is a lot of his lay practitioners, in order to do this back in medieval Japan, a lot of the people who were studying with him probably were people in the higher echelons of society. They probably were people of power. They probably were leaders. They probably were politicians. They probably were administrators. So that's who he's talking to here. And he's encouraging them to be bodhisattvas. That the ocean... So that was a quote from a poem, actually. Now here's where Dogen gets into his... where I think he dives deeply in trying to get this across. That the ocean does not exclude water is identity action. Water does not exclude the ocean either. This being so, water comes together to form the ocean. Earth piles up to form mountains. My understanding is that because the ocean itself does not exclude the ocean, it is the ocean, and it is large. Because mountains do not exclude mountains, they are mountains, and they are high. Again, this concept of non-exclusion identity action, beneficial action. And this idea of identity action, so interbeing, the action piece here is upright, with integrity, stepping out in the world and taking an action. So it's calling us forth to take action. So I'm going to wind up by trying to bring this back. So generosity, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action, or cooperation, or interbeing. Those are the four methods of guidance, Bodhisattva's methods of guidance. They were originally stated by the Buddha, expounded upon by Dogen in this essay, and then expounded upon by Zen teachers since. What I want to do now is I want to bring it back to our practice. So do that. Be generous. Speak kindly. Be beneficial in your action. Do good things for the world, and do it with this. Do your actions in this from the sense of identity with others and yourself, even those unpleasant parts of yourself. This is the Four Noble Truths. This is the Four Noble Truths. Because, and I seem to be coming back to this a lot, the Four Noble Truths are about action. They aren't concepts to be thought about and debated. They're calls to action. So suffering exists. Suffering exists, the First Noble Truth. And the action there is to embrace it, to embrace the change, to embrace the suffering, to embrace the dark spots of yourselves and embrace the dark spots of others. Embrace change, embrace the world, embrace the ephemerality of the world. It's a call to action, to do that, to be in the midst of change. Second Noble Truth, there's a cause of suffering, causes craving, grasping, and the call to action is to let go. To let go of wanting things to turn out the way you want them to be. To let go of your desire to have that person you're having tea with to be the person that they were yesterday. To let go. And that's what we do when we sit. We embrace the present moment, and it's constantly changing outside and inside, and it really only is inside, but this all we're doing when we're sitting is embracing the spontaneity and ephemerality of the moment, and we're coming back to letting go of wanting to control it. Third Noble Truth, what is the Third Noble Truth? Cessation. Is that the truth? Cessation? Cessation exists? Anyways, experience cessation, which is our practice. Sitting on the cushion. So, sitting on the cushion, being open to what's the ephemerality of the moment and what's changing, letting go of our desire to stop it from changing, obsessing on some way to stop it from changing, and experiencing the cessation, the quiet. That's our practice. That's the Four Noble Truths. Then, cultivate the Eightfold Path. So out of that, I would say, related to this talk, I would say cultivate the Bodhisattva's methods. Really doesn't matter. I mean, that'll work. The Bodhisattva's method will work just as well as the Eightfold Path. But it's also it's more pragmatic in some ways than the Eightfold Path. So this is about our practice. This is about our sitting meditation, and it's about being in the world. When we sit, we often dedicate the merit at the end of a sitting, And what that is that's basically, one way to think about that is that what we've experienced on the cushion, let it go out into the world. Let it go out into the world. And the way it goes out in the world is through the Eightfold Path or these methods. So I think that's all I wanted to talk about today, but I'm also